I have thus explained to you the gross, material, gigantic conception of the personality of Godhead. One who sincerely desires liberation concentrates his mind on this form of the Lord because there is nothing more than this in the material world. Purport. In the Bhagavad Gita 9.10, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has verily explained that the material nature is only an order-carrying agent of His. She is one of the different potencies of the Lord, and she acts under His direction only. As the Supreme Transcendental Lord, He simply casts a glance over the material principle, and thus the agitation of matter begins, and the resultant actions are manifested one after another by six kinds of gradual differentiations. All material creation is moving in that way, and thus it appears and disappears in due course. Less intelligent persons with a poor fund of knowledge cannot accommodate the thought of this inconceivable potency of the Lord, Sri Krishna, by which He appears just like a human being. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 11. His appearance in the material world as one of us is also His causeless mercy upon the fallen souls. He is transcendental to all material conceptions, but by His unbounded mercy upon His pure devotees, He comes down and manifests Himself as the personality of Godhead. Materialistic philosophers and scientists are too much engrossed with atomic energy and the gigantic situation of the universal form, and they offer respect more seriously to the external phenomenal feature of material manifestations than to the noumenal principle of spiritual existence. The transcendental form of the Lord is beyond the jurisdiction of such materialistic activities, and it is very difficult to conceive that the Lord can be simultaneously localized and all-pervasive, because the materialistic philosophers and scientists think of everything in terms of their own experience. Because they are unable to accept the personal feature of the Supreme Lord, the Lord is kind enough to demonstrate the Virat feature of His transcendental form. And herein, Srila Shukadev Goswami has vividly described this form of the Lord. He concludes that there is nothing beyond this gigantic feature of the Lord. None of the materialistic thoughtful men can go beyond this conception of the gigantic form. The minds of the materialistic men are flickering and constantly changing from one aspect to another. Therefore, one is advised to think of the Lord by thinking of any part of His gigantic body, and by one's intelligence only one can think of Him in any manifestation of the material world, the forest, the hill, the ocean, the man, the animal, the demigod, the bird, the beast, or anything else. Each and every form of the material manifestation entails a part of the body of the gigantic form, and thus the flickering mind can be fixed in the Lord only and nothing else. This process of concentrating on the different bodily parts of the Lord will gradually diminish the demoniac challenge of godlessness and bring about gradual development of devotional service to the Lord. Everything being a part and parcel of the complete whole, the neophyte student will gradually realize the hymns of the Isho Upanishad, which state that the Supreme Lord is everywhere, and thus he will learn the art of not committing any offense to the body of the Lord. This sense of God-mindedness will diminish one's pride in challenging the existence of God. Thus one can learn to show respect to everything, for all things are parts and parcels of the Supreme Body. In the purport to the previous verse, Srila Prabhupada, in the first sentence, stated, monotheism is practically suggested here. There's a common misunderstanding that Krishna consciousness, or Hinduism, Hinduism is polytheism, pantheism. Polytheism means worship of many gods. Pantheism means worshiping everything as God. But those small percentage of Hindus who are philosophical, many of them will state that no, it's monotheistic, that the various forms that people may worship are all manifestations of the one ultimate reality that is formless. That's not what Srila Prabhupada is teaching here. It's not what Shukadeva Goswami is teaching here. Monotheism is practically suggested here in the purport to text 37. And in text 38, Srila Prabhupada recommends, following the directions of this chapter, for materialistic men to meditate on any part of the gigantic manifestation, the gross manifestation. Gross in German means large, is it not? And in English it means material in this context. So either way you take it. Meditate on the gross manifestation and think of that as God, which is kind of pantheism. So monotheism with polytheism also allowed, worship of different gods also allowed, for persons who are not ready to come to the level of monotheism. Polytheism, pantheism, seeing everything as God, which is in one sense is true, but it's not a full conception. But it's a start. And Srila Prabhupada says that meditating on the different parts, bodily parts of the Lord will gradually diminish the demoniac challenge of godlessness, which is particularly prominent in the last few years in the Western world, especially especially Britain and America. There's this whole atheist attack on theism, and the Christians have rallied themselves out of a several century slumber of almost no intellectual philosophical activity to state that, well, there is God. And many people don't bother about all this at all, and they just go on with either worship of God, or they're not professedly atheists, but more or less they are, because they have no interest in religion. And there are also increasingly in the Western world people who want to go back to, although it's not them really going back to, or they want to adopt, or they do adopt pre-Christian religions as far as they understand what those pre-Christian religions are, because the Christians did a pretty good job of wiping them out. So such things as witchcraft and worshipping nature, druidism, and all this kind of thing. So such people, they won't be atheists in the same way that Richard Dawkins, the high priest of atheism in the modern world, is an atheist, in which the atheist in the sense that not only are they dismissive of the concept of a God, but of anything beyond that which is gross. In other words, they are materialists in the philosophical sense of the term, which means that they don't think there's anything beyond matter. And one prominent atheist in Britain, at least she was prominent enough to get a mention in a book against atheism, she's what she calls herself a Zen Buddhist. So they can be atheists and Buddhists at the same time. But the real staunch, hardcore Dawkins followers, they don't accept it. Buddhism, anything, nothing even slightly smelling of metaphysics is allowed in their system. So they say that there's nothing more than matter. Asatyam apratishtam te, it's already described in Bhagavad Gita, millions of years ago, it's nothing new. Asatyam apratishtam te jagadahuranishwaram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kama haitukam. The demons say, demons, atheists, same thing. The demons say that there's no ultimate truth, there's no basis to the universe, there's no God. Everything comes into being simply... Actually, if we see the purport to this verse, we see that Srila Prabhupada addresses various prominent atheistic theories, and this particular aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kama hetukam. Everything has come into being simply by lust. This addresses the atheistic Sankhya philosophy of thinking that there's Prakriti and Purush, and they come together and everything is formed as such without any particular God. And in the modern age, Srila Prabhupada speaks here in this purport about materialistic philosophers and scientists are too much engrossed with atomic energy and the gigantic situation of the universal form. So that means from the microcosm to the macrocosm, as far as they can envisage the macrocosm, because after all, we're on one tiny little planet somewhere, and what is the macrocosm is far greater than we can observe, even with the best of telescopes. So mundane scientists are very interested in the atom, or what is at the smallest level, and with the massive universe. In other words, they're just interested in matter. From science deals with matter, what they call science in the modern age, from the smallest level to the largest level. And they say, they think that, well, if you understand this, you understand everything, because that's all there is. There's nothing else. There's only matter. We can only see matter. There's nothing else. So if our Krishna conscious movement is, if it becomes prominent, which certainly Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted it to, Bhaktivinoda Thakur wanted it to, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada, they all worked very hard to make this Krishna conscious movement prominent, then we can expect many challenges, because this is a philosophical movement, still as much as we have, at least if we have classes once a day in the temple, then at least we can lay some claim to be a philosophical movement. And we have books of philosophy which challenge every philosophy in the world, both present, past, and future. Both, I went to three. By establishing Krishna to Bhagavan Swayam, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by establishing that on a philosophical basis. So we can expect that that will be challenged in future, beginning from the very epistemology of why do we accept the Vedas. So we can expect many philosophical challenges in future, and actually if we take up the philosophical challenge now, then we can become prominent. If we don't, then we don't become prominent. As Srila Prabhupada explained about Krishna, that Krishna became prominent not by dancing with the gopis and stealing butter, but he became prominent and well known in the world by fighting with demons. So in our Krishna conscious movement, Srila Prabhupada also explained that we can become prominent by fighting with the demons. The atheists are demons. They may be very suave, gentlemanly in their behavior, talking about the good of the world and all this, but actually they're demons because they reject that there is any God. So that is the definition of a demon. Dvau bhutao sarge loke smin daiva asura evacha Vishnu bhakta smrito daiva asuryas tad viparyayaha. In this world there are two kinds of being. One is called godly and the other is called ungodly, or asura, or in the English word that Srila Prabhupada chose generally to describe asura. They are demons. So those who are godly, they are the worshippers of Vishnu, and those who are ungodly, demoniac, they are just the opposite. So we can take up the philosophical challenge, and that will also help to establish this movement. Although establishing this movement is not in and of itself our aim, just like some people try to establish a communist party or a Christian religion or something like this. It's not that we're just in the business of organizational expansion in competition with anyone else, but we want to establish Krishna consciousness for the welfare of human society, and that is possible by removing ignorance. That ignorance can be removed by Bhagavat Tattva Vijnana Mukta Sangasya Jayate, by scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead as received in the Srimad Bhagavatam, by which one becomes free from all misconceptions, of which there are unlimited permutations and combinations within the world. But the Srimad Bhagavatam is the shining light of knowledge, Puranaka, the sun-like Purana, which will give light to the people suffering in the age of Kali. Impersonalism, Srila Prabhupada especially, defined his mission in terms of defeating impersonalism, or saving the Western countries from impersonalism and voidism. Not particularly this gross atheism, but it comes to the same thing also. Just like this Dawkins, he has his philosophy, which it's actually a speculative philosophy, but the way he talks as if it's a scientifically proved fact. But his philosophy, in philosophical terms, I don't think he's very familiar with philosophy, actually. He's someone who's studied science, and he's talking philosophy. He doesn't even realize he's doing it, and he's never studied. I don't think, from his very poor philosophical presentations, I don't think he's ever studied philosophy at any level. But he has an extreme form of materialism and determinism, in which he thinks that, well, there was a Big Bang, and then, as we all know, scientifically proved fact, yes, that there was a big explosion, and then everything's, whatever's going on is just the aftermath of that explosion, and really, Jagad Ahur and Ishvaram, there's no God in control, there's no one in control, it's just chemicals floating around here and there, and chemicals, they don't determine anything by themselves. They're just moved by the primeval forces, which are still from the Big Bang. They're still banging, and the chemicals just move, and they have no volition or will to organize themselves in any way, which includes us. We are all combinations of chemicals, and ultimately there's no such thing as free will. There's no such thing as any person. There's no real thing as any person, what we think of as any person, because we're all just combination of chemicals, and we don't have any choice in what we do or think, because it's all determined by, it's already predetermined. And if we could work out all the equations for it and put it into a super, super, super computer, we could chart the whole future history of the universe. Well, maybe not with chaos theory and all these kinds of things. And many things you can't determine. Maybe, anyway. Anyway, it's an extreme determinant. Everything is determined. But not by any person, but just by impersonal forces. Of course, he doesn't live like that. Impersonalists and atheists, who they don't live their life like that. Just like an impersonalist may say, well, everything's all the same, or it's all one. And we say, okay, well, the money in your pocket, if it's in your pocket or my pocket, it's all the same because it's all one, so let's just transfer it to my pocket. Or, nothing is real, they say nothing. Brahma satyam jagan mithya, this world is false. Okay, so give them a good hard slap in the face. And it's all false. As Brahma is the only reality. They don't live like that. They get hungry and they eat, which means they're under the laws of nature. Laws of nature means that they are controlled. There's a controller. But they don't think like that. They don't think very deeply at all. So Dawkins, he also doesn't live like that or act like that. Well, we're just all chemical. If everything's just chemicals and everything's already determined, then why do you go around preaching atheism and trying to make people into atheists? What's the point? If all we are is just a group of chemicals that comes into being within eternity for a very short time and then dissolves, then so what? Then nothing has any meaning whatsoever. His response to that, that the idea that Krishna, that religion gives meaning to life, he said, yeah, I've got meaning in my life. I went with my friends just before I wrote this. I went to the pub with my friends and we had a good meal and drank some beer, and that's the meaning. Like John Lennon, Yoko and me, that's reality. Idiot. No one lives their life like that. It's impractical, completely impractical. The idea that, well, there's nothing but atoms. If you study atoms and how they react, then you understand everything, because that's all there is. There's nothing but atoms, right? It's a massive philosophical leap to presume that reality is all that we can observe. It's not even a very scientific, and definitely it's not a philosophical position to just presume. We can observe atoms. Well, actually, they can't observe subatomic particles, not directly. They can only speculate that they exist and perform various experiments by which they say that verify the existence of various subatomic particles, but they don't actually directly observe them. And even if they do, then there comes the question of whether various philosophical positions. I mean, one philosophical position, it's not a very good philosophical position, but it is one philosophical position, is that of solipsism, that, well, how do you know that actually that anyone or anything exists anyway except yourself? It can't be philosophically disproved. So the presumption that, well, if we understand atoms, then we can understand it. Of course, they can't understand atoms either. They're having a big problem with that for almost 100 years because of this. First, they used to think that electrons were things happily floating around the nucleus of an atom, and then they discovered, well, it's not really like that. It's more like waves. If you want, you can think of an electron as a particle, but it doesn't follow all the rules that we set up or that we observe for particles. So it's also a wave, and it's a wave particle, which is... What does that mean, a wave particle? It's either it's a wave or a particle, but it's both. And then it becomes metaphysical. It becomes beyond that which we can imagine. So they don't really understand what it is, although they make a good job of trying to convince everyone that they do understand what it is. And they say, well, if you understand this, then you can understand everything. But it just presumes with absolutely no backing, no substance, that all of reality fits within that which we can imagine. In fact, Yamuna Acharya, many long ago, Ulangita Trividasim Uta Shishai, praising Lord Vishnu, he said that you are beyond the three kinds of limitations, namely space, time, and thought. It's not that God has to be within what we can study. If you can't fit him in a test tube, and if you can't see him in your telescope, then can't exist. Why? Because, well, it's not scientific. Then science becomes God, and then scientist becomes God. So there's so many questions. Why then, if we're just chemicals, why has there been throughout history, as much as these ignorant people know it, they say history just goes back a few thousand years, has there been a search for truth among more intellectual kinds of people? What is this search for truth? If matter is all there is, then why a search for truth? The animals, they don't search for truth. They just search for food and sex. So why do humans search for truth? Why, over generations, have people been impelled to think that there is something more than simply chemicals and their interactions? If that is all there is, then what prompts us to think that there's more than just getting born, growing up, living for some time, and having some kids, and then dying? Why? What is it that prompts us to think that there's something more? Why are we not content just to eat some food and have some sex and grunt a little bit? Or actually, humans have more developed faculties, so we believe, of communication than animals that simply grunt or roar. We have developed languages. So where does this discontent come, that we're not content simply to eat? Why study science? Forget about the search for the truth. Well, let's not forget about it. But even at the physical level, what to speak of the metaphysical level, what impels us? Why is it that we want to know why? Why is it that Isaac Newton contemplated, why is the apple falling down? So what if the apple falls down? If you pick it up and eat it, should offer it to Krishna, but he doesn't know those things. But if matter is all there is, then why is all this big effort to study so many things, and you become a researcher in chemistry, and then you die early from inhaling so many chemicals, and research into radioactivity and X-rays and all this kind of thing. They didn't know that it was carcinogenic, so little known to them while they were investigating X-rays, and they were also setting themselves up to die earlier. So why this impulse, this urge to study, or to think, or even people who are not philosophically inclined like this, to think that there is a God protecting me, or gods, or some spirit, or guardian angels, or whatever. Pray to God, or gods, or whatever. Now, if we accept Darwin's theory that we're all in the or neo-Darwinism, that we're all in the evolutionary process, the struggle to survive, it would seem that praying to God is not a very good evolutionary tool. It'd be better just to get a piece of, rip a branch off a tree and defend yourself, rather than pray to God. What evolutionary purpose does it serve? Well, according to Dawkins, he's got a solution to that. That why do we find that in all cultures all over the world that have ever been studied since time immemorial, all humans have some kind of religious system, whether it's very primitive and actually this one reason I see that many of the atheists are disgusted with religion is because much of what goes on in the name of religion is actually primitive and barbaric, and several of the so-called great religions of the world, they were just tribal religions based on very low instincts, which somehow became popular. And then they got some Greek atheistic philosophies. They didn't have any philosophy, so they found out something in the ancient Greeks and joined it up and this and that. But basically, it's not on a very high level at all. But anyway, Dawkins' explanation for this, brilliant explanation, it's all a delusion. That somewhere in the evolutionary code, in the genetic code, something went wrong, and many people are still carrying this gene, so far undiscovered, which makes them believe in God. Pretty speculative. But if you're an Oxford accredited evolutionist and you speak it with enough conviction, then people who are mostly stupid, which doesn't help them evolutionarily or in any other way, they tend to believe it. Another kind of delusion. That's what he's doing. It's a delusion by saying, well, actually people believe in God because there's something wrong in the genetic coding, and he's just talking nonsense. He's making a delusion. Then the other thing, there are very serious problems with this totally materialistic view of reality, because even according to their own theories, for the world to be as we see it today, there are, I believe, 26 mathematical constants which have to be in place. They're just like the weak force and the strong force within atoms, the gravitational force, and then, Hubble's force, and so many forces, electromagnetic force. They all have to be exactly at the levels they're at, not more or less, and finely tuned. And we're talking about figures here of powers to the minus huge numbers. In other words, the possibility of any one of these forces coming into being exactly at that level is what, according to probability theory, would be called zero. Because when you have 0.00000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 have 26 such forces, then it becomes impossible raised to the power of 26, which is ridiculous even to say such a thing. In more than one way, it's ridiculous to say. But never mind. The scientists have an answer to this. It's called the anthropic principle, which means that, well, even though it seems impossible, it must have happened because we're here today to observe it, which is no explanation whatsoever. It's just like saying that I can say to you, well, actually, I am a duck. And someone can say, well, you don't look like a duck, or talk like a duck, or walk like a duck, or eat like a duck, or quack like a duck. Yeah, but I said I'm a duck, so I'm a duck. Science. So it's just on their assertion that there's no need for any other explanation, because we've worked it all out, and we've even got a fancy name for it. It's called the anthropic principle. And there's no need to bring God in. We can explain everything by science, but it doesn't explain anything. When our without a designer for the universe to be the way it is, according to scientific theory, impossible. But they just put a name, anthropic principle, and then they just throw out all good sense and present it as science, which is cheating, actually, to give a straightforward word on it. They say we can explain everything by science, no need of God. We explain you. Who are you? What are you? And I say, well, I'm just chemicals. Then why do... How did it come about that you, bag of chemicals, are attracted to Mrs. Dawkins? Where's the attraction? It's not like iron is attracted to a magnet, or acid is attracted to alkali. It's not like that. It's much more complex. What is it that constitutes personality? They can't explain. They just say, well, it's all in the brain. And we haven't discovered it yet, but it's in the brain. Well, they used to say that the principle of life is in the atoms, and then they said it was in the cells, and then they found that wasn't true, and then they said it was in the enzymes, and they said, well, and then they found it, that wasn't true. And then they said, well, it's in other proteins. And then they did more research and they found that wasn't true. And then they said it's in the DNA. And they found, oh, now we found the secret of life, DNA. And then they searched that and, well, it's not really. And now it's in the brain. But they haven't discovered it yet. And it's going on like that. But if they say, well, we're just atoms, but atoms or... as they exist as molecules or whatever, matter doesn't experience fear, joy, love, hunger. There's no experience in matter. Whether you take matter to be, either from a classical physical point of view or quantum point of view, there's no experience. What do you mean by we scientists? We scientists believe. How do atoms believe anything? We can have the hydrogen atoms going up against the oxygen atoms, and then we'll have disturbed water. But it's we can't even begin to think about it. It doesn't make any sense. How can a group of atoms consider themselves a person, a discrete being, different from others? How is that possible? Atoms don't have that. There's no consciousness. Consciousness is the missing link. That book has made consciousness the missing link. They want to explain consciousness in terms simply of impulses within the brain. But consciousness is not dependent on the brain. There are people whose brain is dead who are still conscious, or who don't have brains, literally don't have brains. Where the brain should be, there's just some liquid. There are a few people like that, and they function normally without a brain. So this is the stuff of philosophy which goes beyond simply matter. Materialistic philosophy is extremely limited. It's not that this is anything new, this total materialism. But it's a challenge that we should rise to. What else they say? Religion causes wars. Well, religion may cause wars, but the scientists, they really help the job along with all their different inventions for... If the scientists hadn't come along, then we could still have wars with bows and arrows. As Einstein said, I don't know what weapons the Third World War will be fought with, but the Fourth World War will be fought with bows and arrows, because they've invented so many dangerous weapons. But actually, is it religion that causes wars? Not according to the definition that Srila Prabhupada gave, because he said that, or the understanding of the Shastra here, that religion without philosophy is sentimentalism or fanaticism. So it's not really that religion causes war, but it's not real religion, it's fanaticism. And that fanaticism can be expressed through religion, or it can be expressed through Nazism. That was another kind of fanaticism. There's nothing real. It wasn't that that the Second World War was caused by religion, or the First World War for that matter. Or fanaticism, our country. So it all comes down to Dehatma Buddhi, I am this body, ignorance, foolishness. What goes on in the name of religion, people think it's just a kind of belief. You just have to believe, that's all. But that's not what is presented in Gita and Bhagavatam. What's presented in Gita and Bhagavatam is that one should try to understand. Atato brahma jignyasa. Now one has attained the human form of life. One should try to understand. People are fighting wars because they think that by doing so, it's a noble cause. We're doing something for the benefit of mankind, but it's all, or at least our section of mankind, all based on ignorance. So blind faith is never good, whether it's blind faith in science, just like, for instance, so many people, they'll accept, oh, Dawkins said he's a scientist. They don't know his theory. They have not studied his theories in any depth. And even Dawkins himself, he believes in Big Bang Theory. If you ask him to explain it in a scientific way, beyond the most simple thing, which I could do also, that there was a singularity, which is another fancy word, which means they haven't got a clue what actually happened or why it happened. There was mass compressed, an infinite amount of mass compressed into an infinitesimal point, which, how is that possible? Science, please explain. And then it exploded. How it got there, why it exploded, they knowing that they have absolutely no way they can explain it, because it defies whatever rules of science that they've extrapolated, they just call it a singularity, which means nabhavishya, what is it? Nabhuto nabhavishyat. It never happened in the past, and it never previously, and never again. It just kind of happened. So he couldn't explain that, but he has intimate faith in it, nor can he explain. There are so many things, because science is developed in so many ways, and one scientist doesn't know what another scientist is doing. They just accept what they say as being scientific. And in one field, the different people will argue with each other, and in other fields, they just accept whatever is called the orthodox understanding. So it's all a bit of a bluff, not a bit of a bluff, a rather large bluff, in which blind faith predominates. Same thing, they have blind faith in democracy, humanism. And nowadays they don't fight wars in name of, at least from the Western world, wars are not fought in the name of religion, because religion has become subverted to humanism, so they fight wars in the name of humanism. Let's go out to Iraq and remove that Saddam Hussein. He's a bad man, and he needs to be removed so that people can have democracy. And we might, after giving them democracy, we might send in our oil companies also, maybe. So they have another motive, but they say for humanitarian reasons. So it's in the name of humanitarianism, but actually they have another motive. So people may fight a war in the name of religion or in the name of democracy, but they're all badly impelled. Everyone in this world is here because of bad inclinations. They may pretend to be good. It's because of bad inclinations. So, by the grace of Srila Prabhupada and Vyasadeva and Shukadeva Goswami and Lord Sri Krishna, we do in our Krishna conscious mind have this excellent understanding, Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam, scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead. It's not just some blind faith or blind belief. It's comprehensive, which can lead humankind out of the darkness. Tamasima Jyotir Gamaya, come out of the darkness, come into the light. That is the light of knowledge. So we should also be disturbed, just like Dawkins, and it's not just him, but he's the most famous. He's disturbed by religion, and he wants to propagate that this is not good. And actually, most of what goes on in the name of religion is not very good. But we should take this opportunity to present what is actual philosophy, what is actual culture, what is actual religion, by presenting the knowledge in Srila Prabhupada's books, both by distributing his books, by living what's in his books, by speaking what's in his books, and in this way deliver people from their gross atheism or their gross religionism. Hare Krishna. Anything anyone wants to say now? Please say it. Yeah.
You are speaking of the blind faith in science. So, what is about the blind faith in our Shastra?
Blind faith in Shastra. No, blind faith is not good. To have blind faith in the right thing is beneficial. But that is not recommended. Tadvijnanartham sagurum eva abhigacchat. To get that knowledge, the knowledge that takes us beyond this world of suffering, one should approach a guru. Not just blind faith.
In this regard, then, how do you believe the mythology is explained in our Shastra?
How do I believe mythology? We don't believe mythology. Mythology means mithya, false. We don't believe any mythology. Mythology means that which is not true. It's just some belief of foolish people. So we don't accept any mythology. Shastra speaks truth, not mythology. There's no mythology in Shastra. That is a term which the British applied and which Indians who spoke English adopted, but it's a very bad term. Mythology means mitha. Kintu ja shastra se sheda mithana, the satta. Mythology is the wrong word. Just like they say idol for deity. Idol is a very bad word. It means some imagined form. But we don't say idol. We say Sri Vigraha. Idol means Pratima. Pratima or Vigraha. Pratima means just a figure, statue. And Sri Vigraha means the worshipable form of the Lord. So by using these words, they are misleading people. It's not mythology. It's fact. Why do we accept descriptions in Shastra? Ravana has 10 heads. Have you ever seen anyone with 10 heads? No. So why do you believe it? That's what you're asking, is it? Something like that? Well, how much have you seen? How much have we seen? I haven't seen anyone with 10 heads in this lifetime. But does that mean that everything that can possibly exist in all places and all times must exist in this place and this time? Is that a fact? Why should we think that's true? Rather, we should expect that in other places and other times there are things which we don't have experience of now. Science itself works on various assumptions. For instance, that the laws of science apply in all times, places, and circumstances. But there's absolutely no way they can even begin to prove that. They just assume it. So they assume that what's within their experience must be all there is. But even within science, we find that many times someone comes up with a theory and everyone laughs at it, and then later on they accept it. It's a very common thing in science. Some scientist, he first of all proposed that, what is that, the electrons, they're moving like as if in a musical harmony. And everyone laughed. They said, that's not science. Now they accept it. They don't know. Their method of understanding is that they observe and they make some theory based on what they observe, applying their intelligence. And we take knowledge, Veda. Veda means knowledge. Who wrote the Vedas? Apaurusheya. They're always existing. Because knowledge is always existing. 1 + 1 = 2. It's always a fact. Right? It can change though. Just like if you bring a man and woman together, you can have 1 + 1 after some time equals 5. Right? But at least in terms of numbers, 1 + 1 = 2. So what is true, what is always true, that knowledge exists independently of the phenomenon itself. I am sitting here. That I am sitting here and the phenomenon of my sitting here. Here we're getting into the phenomenal and noumenal, which Prabhupada mentions here. They're not exactly the same thing. Apple and apple-ness are not exactly the same thing. I said the word apple. In your mind came an idea. Apple. Which apple? Red. No specific apple.
Green.
Oh, I thought of a red one, actually. You thought of a green one. I thought of a red one. In India, you only see red apples. They're more popular for some reason. Although, in Indian culture, you're not supposed to eat red food. So we have a concept in our mind of appleness, which transcends or is separate from every apple. So knowledge of an object and the object itself are not, they're not the same thing, but they're intimately linked. So Veda means knowledge, which is all, it always exists. Aparoshaya, no one wrote the Vedas. They always exist. So we take knowledge from Veda. Anything else? Yeah. Then have an argument over green apples and red apples. It's green, it's red. It's green, it's red. Let's make a compromise. Half green, half red. And someone will come and say, no, it's yellow. This is a lot of philosophy, so-called philosophy, goes on such silly arguments as this.
And another
Who can come up with the silliest argument of them all? Competition.
Bhaktivedanta Institute created by Dr.
Singh. Created by Srila Prabhupada, actually.
Srila Prabhupada, who is a former child.
Prabhupada created BI.
To defeat the theories of religions and Darwinists, Bhaktivedanta Swami had the idea to develop this Bhaktivedanta.
Prabhupada, we call him Prabhupada usually.
Wanted to open the door of alternative for the scientists.
Open the door of?
A dialogue between science and religion. To actually expose to the scientists that God is not dead, but God is a person and is alive, and then to give them a chance to go beyond these theories of reductionism and Darwinism, and beyond the boundaries of reductionism and Darwinism. And the Srila Prabhupada was inspiring Srila Bhakti Swami to start this conference on life, concern of life.
Yeah. Well, from what I understand of what's recorded of Srila Prabhupada, he actually said to challenge them.
Sure.
He used the word challenge.
Exactly.
It wasn't just all speaking with them and smiling. He used the very clearly wanted to challenge the scientists.
To defeat their theory that life is coming from matter.
Yeah.
Therefore, they started to they organized this conference in Vrindavan and Rome, also life comes from life. Invited so many scientists, Nobel laureates also, and all around the world. And then the dialogue started to sprout between the scientists and religionists also, and spiritualists also. In this way, today you can see there are many subsequent groups starting to develop conferences, and even Muslim also here in Zurich, there was some Muslim.
Yeah, because Islam's also under attack. Any religious system is under attack from gross atheism. So they're trying to organize themselves. No, there are many... one reason why Dawkins became so ballistic and others became so aggressive because... particularly because this intelligent design movement started to become prominent in America, headed by scientists. So, therefore Dawkins and company became strong, but actually they're doomed. They're going to have to come up with some other atheistic theory. They're not going to become theists, because that's their nature. Do bhuto sarge lokasmin daiva asura eva cha. There are two kinds of people, theists and atheists. So those who are determined atheists, you can give them all good reasons, and they still won't accept it. Matena Krishna Paratasvatova. Mitobi Padyeta Griha Vratanam. They're determined to be demons. But for people who are more reasonable, they can be swayed by good arguments. But Darwinistic evolutionary theory is still very prominent and very strong in the world, but it's already been given its death sentence by intelligent design theory. But one problem, major problem, is that people became atheists. All of Europe was extremely religious at one point. Switzerland included, of course. Calvin and company. How did they become predominantly atheistic or agnostic or apathetic to the whole question? Well, one major reason was Martin Luther pointed that out, the misuse of religion. So he tried to reform make a fresh start altogether. He started the Christian Ritvik movement. No authority, just read the book and understand it yourself. It's you and God and the Bible, that's all. So it's like Ritvikism, it's just you and Prabhupada and his books. You just study it and you set yourself up as an authority without ever having surrendered to a guru or served him. But what's gone on in the name of Christianity for so many years is really, it really turns people off, and the philosophy itself, the idea, this one devotee in America who's been successful to some extent in bringing young people into Krishna consciousness, which is quite unusual in the Western world. When I visit our ISKCON temples around in the Western world, I think I'm in the geriatric ward of a hospital. So he's been quite successful in bringing young people in, but he says you have to be very careful. He said it's best in the beginning, don't even say the word God, because people, God, and they think, oh no, some religion in which they have this God who throws you into hell. It's a very poor theology that they have. That you have one life, you believe the right thing, and then you're saved. And if you don't, you're thrown in hell forever by the all-merciful, all-loving God. It's a horrible idea. And it's based on blind faith, because how can you know whether you should be a Shia Muslim or a Sunni Muslim or a Catholic or a Protestant? More than 2,000 Protestant churches. Which one is the right one that you get saved by? And everyone else goes to hell. So one reason for atheists being dogged atheists is if they think, well, if we have to accept religion, we have to accept that these ideas, which are actually, it's developed from a tribal religion. Christianity is predicated on Judaism, which is a tribal religion. They talk about the 12 tribes. God looks after us, and God beats up our enemies for us, and defeats their gods. So it's not very developed. This Vedic knowledge is far, far superior. I mean, they don't even have the understanding that when we die, we're born again. It's the most basic point of spiritual knowledge, the first thing to be understood, and they don't accept it.
Shripad Bhaktiswami Damodar is writing on his webpage, tdsing.org, is all about the shifting of the paradigm of Darwinism to spirituality.
Spirituality, we should be a bit more clear. So, Prabhupada didn't use the word spirituality hardly. Spiritual knowledge would be more. If you say spirituality, then it brings in, you know, Amma, Sai Baba, Buddhism. Let's be more focused. Spiritual knowledge. Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam. means spiritual knowledge.
So actually, the conference is needed by
great.
We can see actually on those some trace of actually today is going on in India and also in Switzerland, how the, some scientists they accept to bring the concept of spirituality or soul.
Yeah, but we have to be more clear. If you just say spirituality, it just leaves everything too vague. Let's have some real specific knowledge. Spirituality, it's nirvishesh, non-specific. Let's be more clear. A general concept of spirituality, that brings us to Mayavad. If it's just general, nirvishesh, without specific, then it comes to Mayavad. So we should come to clear knowledge. What is the nature of the soul? That has to be the clear understanding of the soul has to be defined in relationship to Krishna. Mayavad or impersonalism can be a step up from gross materialism, as Prabhupada suggests in this purport. But you've still got a long way to go. Anyway, Hare Krishna. We'll finish there. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.